applying mindfulness to compassion for self, which I think, especially for women, is very, very difficult and is incredibly impactful when you start to think differently. And you might think it's not possible to think differently, because that's what I thought. And we don't have to believe our thoughts. Our brains are plastic. They can change. And thinking about speaking to yourself as you would a very dear loved one is really a pivotal shift, I think, in stress reduction.
This is the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast, and I'm your host, Maya Acosta. If you're willing to go with me, together we can discover how simple lifestyle choices can help improve our quality of life and increase our longevity in a good way. Let's get started. Welcome back to another episode of the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast. I'm your host, Maya Acosta. Ladies, I am so excited to be having this conversation with you today. So we have Dr. Anne Connard, who will be talking to us about a well woman checkup. Now, I love this conversation, so I'm going to encourage you to listen to all of it because we are going to cover the pillars of lifestyle medicine. But imagine that, you know, every year you go for your wellness exam. And what Dr. Connard says, it's really been reduced to having a pap smear and a breast exam. That's pretty much what our exams look like. Our OB-GYNs do not always go into detail about lifestyle modifications that we can make to improve our health. And so it can be very frustrating if, you know, we're having just basic screening and nothing else. And so Dr. Anne Connard is here to talk to us about the pillars of lifestyle medicine. And we go through detail one by one, really taking in some of those recommendations. Now, this episode is full of resources. So I'm going to see if I can put them all in our show notes. But we are going to talk about the importance of getting restorative sleep, you know, about the benefits of whole food, plant-based nutrition for overall mental well-being, but also to reduce the risk of hot flashes. We cover, you know, reducing our alcohol intake, getting that physical exercise that's so important for bone health. And then the importance of social connection. So lots of great stuff in this episode. I'm actually going to ask you to share it with one special woman in your life. Since this episode is airing in October, it's also Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And I feel like this is a great time to teach women in general about the benefits of implementing these lifestyle pillars into their life. This is one reason why we have this podcast, Lifestyle Medicine Podcast. And so Dr. Connard says that life is your best medicine. So my friends, I hope that you enjoy this episode and let me know what you think about it. Let's welcome Dr. Anne Connard.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
How do you define well-being in the context of women's health?
Thank you. Yes, as an OBGYN, the well woman exam is bread and butter for what we do on a day-to-day basis in the office. And this is an opportunity for women to come in and receive preventative cancer screenings and address health concerns, as well as age-related screening recommendations and a full physical exam. But so often it seems like it's reduced to a breast exam and a pap smear. And especially with the pap guidelines changing over the last few years, you know, for a lot of groups, pap screening is now recommended every 5 years. And so we've seen clinically that women may not follow up every year because they think they need to come in every 5 years for the pap. And this idea that a well woman exam is a pap only is really not serving women, I think. You know, a well woman exam from a more expansive perspective is an opportunity to really assess health in multiple domains, to do a 360 assessment, and an opportunity for a provider and a patient to continue to grow a therapeutic relationship that can be ongoing in service to their health and well-being.
you recently wrote kind of is it an op-ed?
Yeah, no, op-ed or opinion editorial. And this was in response to the New York Times article that came out in February that stated that symptoms of menopause, particularly vasomotor symptoms, were addressed by hormone therapy alone. And as an OBGYN, I prescribe hormone therapy a lot. You know, it helps women tremendously. And there are a subset of women that cannot use or decline to use hormone therapy. And so what do we tell them? You know, just like your experience with your annual exam, how do we educate providers and patients both about other lifestyle options that can be in addition to and or instead of hormone therapy, depending on the patient? And so the publication was to outline other lifestyle options to ease the transition through menopause.
Mm-hmm. And, I have a copy of it here. I thought this was so useful because that's exactly why we have, for example, this platform on my end is to inform my female listeners that there are things that we can do. So is there a way that we can share this piece with my listeners or where could we find it?
Yeah, absolutely. Just check in with Alex on that and perhaps he can advise the best way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I wonder if they could even put it on the ACLM website to just link. That would be more convenient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Dr. Kennard, my goal with the podcast is never to frown upon other physicians that are not trained in lifestyle medicine. That's never the goal. I now understand that it's just information that's not taught. We're very fortunate that more and more people are joining ACLM from all walks of life. So people in various backgrounds in healthcare or even dietitians. So there are many people that are coming into this lifestyle understanding that there are ways that we can support patients. And so knowing that, I'm going to encourage my female listeners to sort of, the whole goal, Dr. Kennard, is really to empower people to take control of their health. So they may not find a physician that is well-informed in lifestyle medicine, but we can begin to learn and take the steps to understand what we can do and then possibly start the conversation with our healthcare providers. What do you think about that?
I agree. You know, this goes to the idea of life as your best medicine is physicians can make recommendations and it's wonderful when physicians are knowledgeable and trained in lifestyle modalities to support patients in their quest for health. But really, it's what happens outside of the exam room. The life is your best medicine idea is that the things that we do on a day-to-day basis have a profound influence on our health and well-being and how we age. And even if somebody does have a significant medical concern that requires ongoing care, how can we live well in spite of those challenges and continue to be well despite a chronic condition?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And so I'm going to kind of pick your brain a little bit as we go through each of the pillars of lifestyle medicine, because on my podcast, I do emphasize nutrition a lot. But we know that there are other components, other pillars that we need to kind of pay attention to improve that whole experience that we're going through as women. So, you know, you just said, typically our annual exam consists of sort of a pap smear and a breast exam, and that's about it. Maybe our physician will ask us, you know, maybe they'll have a conversation about weight. And sometimes we're asked if we drink, which it's always interesting because the checklist may include how much, you know, exercise you have and how much, you know, how much you're exercising a week per week and how much you're drinking. But then I find that there's never really a conversation around those topics. So I was wondering if we can even start with sleep, because I am that person that I have now started to struggle with going to sleep at a reasonable time. And I know that it's not just how many hours of sleep we get, but it's important to have restorative sleep. What does that look like? And why is sleep important?
I'm glad you brought up sleep first, because I think it is the most under-talked about pillar of lifestyle medicine and health, because really nothing is good without good restorative sleep. You know, we can't expect for our mental health to function optimally, cognitive health, physical health, emotional, spiritual, like it all depends on adequate rest. And we see this emphasized in many traditional medical systems, like traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda, really that sleep is a backbone in over 5,000 years of writing. And it is so, so important. And so in terms of sleep, particularly for women and particularly during the menopause transition, it is one of the most common concerns and probably one of the most impactful ways to help women feel better. So we have women with young children that can disrupt sleep, work, shift work sleep disorder, women that are impacted by hormonal changes that influence sleep, and then all of the mental load too that we carry as women, the sandwich generation. There's a lot to keep us up at night. And so how do we address this? There are some good handouts that we can link in the podcast from the ACLM on sleep that are free and available. Some things that I think have been the most impactful tips for myself and my patients are getting good, bright morning light when possible that helps reset the pineal gland to optimally produce melatonin at the right time. Exercising in the morning if possible, but exercise in general will help promote sleep unless it's right up against sleep time, better earlier in the day. Keeping a good steady blood sugar and not overeating at night. Keeping the room cool and dark. There's so many sources of light pollution, even coming through the windows or on plugs. And so I use a great sleep mask that I love called the Manta Mask. And especially as an obstetrician, because I do work overnight delivering babies, and so sometimes need to sleep during the day. So reducing that light pollution and getting the bedroom cool, dark, and comfortable is key. And to have it be a safe space that you can relax in, whatever you need to make that feel like that is worth pursuing. From a hormonal perspective, there are changes in the menopause transition that interrupt sleep architecture and change it. And oftentimes women will report waking up somewhere between midnight and 3 a.m. That 3 a.m. awakening is pretty pathognomonic for perimenopause. And that's something that some women notice improvement with hormone therapy. But it also can be improved, I think, by reducing anxiety around it. In many cultures, that's a natural time of awakening for quiet, reflective practice. Holding it with an open hand, a little journal next to the bed, and then seeing if one can drift back to sleep. Thinking about sleep as letting go of wakening rather than the goal of falling asleep. And there's some botanicals as well and supplements that people use, and that's outside the scope of this podcast, but can be helpful as well in the menopause transition.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things that you mentioned that I'm now doing for myself, which is definitely wearing a mask. I never thought, an eye mask, that is, I never thought that I would require that. Sure, when I travel, But I find that is very soothing now, not only just having that pitch black experience, blocking out all the extra light, but also just the, you know, soothing of having that light pressure on my eyes helps me. And Dr. Kennard, because I am struggling with sleep as well, which is interesting because I'm a night owl, but now I've become an extra late night night owl. So one of the things that I've had to do is use an app, kind of like the Calm app, to either play a meditative, and you can find these things free of charge, like on YouTube, but sort of a recording or white noise or something soothing that will help me to fall asleep. And I'm finding that I'm having to, I need that support now. And you talked about having the anxiety of not being able to sleep can contribute to the inability to fall asleep, especially when you wake up, because I do wake up as well. What do you, any chance, you know, like what is the prevalence of women struggling with restorative sleep nowadays?
Oh my gosh. I mean, when I talk to women about this, it is rare to find somebody that says, I sleep great. I feel rested. You know, we are in culturally in this place of overstimulation, you know, checking phones until late. The brain really needs to be not only off that wavelength of light, but just off that attentiveness for a couple hours before bed. We feel sleepy with alcohol. And so, you know, it's not common that I hear folks drink some wine in the evening to wind down, but that has a profound impact on sleep architecture to where people do not then enter restorative stages of sleep if they've had wine before bed. And so moving that drink into a happy hour type time frame can be more supportive of sleep in terms of alcohol. And, you know, certainly there's lots of benefits in cutting down on alcohol in general, but sleep is one of the most compelling ones, as well as decreasing hot flashes. As you mentioned, you found out personally.
Mm-hmm. Right now, when you were talking about sleep, how that can be thrown off. If we can move into just talking about the role that nutrition plays, not only in what we're eating, I have known of people who have told me that their anxiety improved or was reduced when they changed their diet. I've also had someone say that even their depression, the symptoms of depression improved as they moved away from processed foods and other things towards plant-based nutrition, which I thought was pretty cool. But now we're talking about just our hormonal state, like how women are impacted based on what they eat and how their gut microbiome is impacted as well. What can you tell us about that?
This is so interesting and an emerging area of research. First, I want to touch on what you said about the microbiome and mood, because it is so both interesting and clinically impactful. And so this is newer research coming out, but saying that the gut and the brain are intimately connected. They're connected by the vagus nerve, and the gut is the reservoir for the majority of neurotransmitters in the body. Like 80% of serotonin resides in the gut. And the bugs in the gut, the microbiome, influence both of those in a bidirectional manner. And so this touches on the pillar of stress management, but the things that we can do that improve the tone between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, the ability to get back into a parasympathetic rest and digest state away from a sympathetic fight, flight, freeze, fawn, is both influenced and influences our gut microbiome. And we see clinical differences in anxiety and depression and sleep, actually, from that. So things that people can do in that sense on a life is your best medicine type thought on that is exercises that tone the vagus nerve. So even something like humming, any of the mind-body practices, yoga, tai chi, qigong, it doesn't need to be exercise, but the breath work, the body awareness, any of the contemplative practices, mindfulness, self-compassion, all of those build neuroplasticity, that is, can actually rewire the brain towards the frontal lobe of the brain, away from the midbrain, which is the fight flight area. And so over time, the ability of the body to regulate the nervous system, which feeds back to the gut, is improved and clinically noticeable. So back to the gut. So in the gut, it is influenced by the stress management and chronic stressors on the body, and also profoundly influenced by nutrition, which has been, again, documented by these health systems over millennia. We see that Hippocrates stated the same. And what we put in really matters. And it matters in terms of hormones, which is an emerging area of research as well. And so hormones, and when I say that, I right now I'm speaking specifically to estrogen as an example. Estrogen, its normal pathway of metabolism and excretion is through the gut. And there are enzymes in the microbiome that can influence that, how much is metabolized and excreted versus how much is resorbed through the gut and re-enters the bloodstream. And we see microbiome differences with a whole food, plant-forward style diet, that has a healthier, more robust metabolism and excretion of estrogens, as opposed to a microbiome that's more reflective of a standard American diet or ultra-processed foods, where the estrogen is actually not metabolized and it's reabsorbed. And some clinical differences in terms of circulating both amounts of estrogens and impact on estrogen-mediated cancers and disorders like uterine fibroids.
I'm so thankful for having learned about the power of plant-based foods, because I'll tell you, as you're talking about the hormonal balances that these foods can contribute to, I'm thinking of just how we often say, where's the fiber, if you're eating sort of a Western standard American diet, which is void in many times of fiber. And so just as a reminder for my listener is that many of these whole foods have their fiber intact. I mean, it's right there, especially when you're eating legumes and greens, and all of that can help move out that excess estrogen. And that's what you're telling us, right, Dr. Carnard?
Yes. For estrogen metabolism to work as well as it should, there needs to be not only fiber itself, but really a range of plant-based foods. I think they say having 40 different distinct plants in a day is ideal for the microbiome, which is really a lot, but things like herbs count. So it doesn't have to be like a whole, you know, cup of each thing. But the range and the rainbow of fruits and vegetables contributes not only the fiber, but a range of phytonutrients that are incredibly important for health and all body processes. In terms of women's health in particular, I think focusing on a couple of those phytonutrients and subcomponents, lignans. I get a lot of questions on phytoestrogens, which are mostly found in soy-based products.
So going back to lignans, it was only, this is before I even learned about whole food plant-based lifestyle. I did a little bit because I was, you know, I dabbed into things back in the day. Flax seeds. I had no idea if you'd like to kind of expand a little bit on the benefits of flax seeds, but I remember reading about, I think the reason that I got more involved in adding flax seeds
into my diet was because of menstrual cramps that I used to have back in the day, that they can help. Flax seeds are good overall for women's health, aren't they?
Yeah, flax seeds are really high in lignans. Lignin is a certain type of fiber that is a woody, not breakdownable fiber. And then the flax seeds also have the healthy fats as well. In particular, the lignans seem to bind up cholesterol and can help regulate hormonal metabolism. We can link, I have a recipe for flax power balls, because if you have not eaten flax seeds, they are not super palatable on their own. They're better in other things. I like them in oatmeal and overnight oats and even sprinkled on a salad. It's really important with the fats that are very easily rancid, that they be kept in the freezer. And so flax seeds, particularly if they are ground flax seeds, should be stored in the freezer and then just brought out for use as needed.
Thank you for that tip, because I do keep a little jar of ground flax seeds in the refrigerator, but I have forgotten about that. It is true. I've heard people say that even walnuts and other things like that should be kept in the freezer, and they store well. They actually don't freeze, do they?
No, they don't freeze, and it doesn't impact the taste, which is sort of peculiar, but it's another good tip too for fish oil, which is another thing that can both go rancid and just have a very strong taste. If somebody is taking fish oil supplements, put it in the freezer. It will decrease the fishy taste in those fish burps. And then my trick with fish oil is to add it to a salad dressing or something else with oil so that it disappears. And it's much more palatable that way.
Yes. So speaking of, since we're still on the topic of nutrition, I love that you have that training on integrative medicine with Andrew Weil through the Andrew Weil Center. I was a fan of his, again, long before I learned about lifestyle medicine and whole food plant-based nutrition. So you have a cookbook called Nourish, an integrative medicine cookbook, which I'm very excited about. Often when I talk about, you know, what we should eat, I kind of just say something like a Buddha bowl and consider the Daily Dozen by Dr. Michael Greger. Like, that's the easiest way for me to think of, like, have layer your Buddha bowl and add various ingredients that you find in the Daily Dozen. What will we find in your cookbook?
Well, I am a busy mom. I have two little girls and work full time as an OBGYN. And so I needed to put something together that had healthy food that tasted good, that was able to be prepared ahead of time, and that could last for several meals. And so things in terms of food, there's a lot. I really love soups and stews. It's a wonderful way to add a ton of plant foods in a way that is easy to eat and tastes good. And, you know, from a practical perspective, it's a great way to minimize food waste too, because those vegetables that are dying, you know, I call my vegetable drawer the vegetable hospice. You know, I buy it with the best of intentions, but then life gets away. So putting those kind of limp veggies in a soup is a really great way to use them up. So lots of soups and stews, things like overnight oatmeal, those flax power balls are in there. Nice drinks, how to make things that are palatable for kids. And then there are some simple herbal medicine recipes in there, things like elderberry syrup, just very practical things for use, and some mind body recipes as well, different breath work or restorative yoga practices.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I love that you have that training in Ayurveda and herbal medicine, because those are the areas that were very interesting to me early on. You know, I read a review recently on the podcast that was someone left a review for my podcast, and they kind of use the mind-body verbiage, I guess you could say. Like, I always think of lifestyle medicine, and they were like, no, it's mind-body kind of driven podcast. And I thought, oh my God, yes. Going back to like my original interest, which was on the holistic approach, I'm not trained in Ayurveda, but I like that approach as well. And herbal medicine, all these other modalities that we can use to improve our health is what I love touching on the podcast. So I'm excited that you prescribe that as well.
Those are my first loves. And just to briefly state too, Ayurveda and lifestyle medicine are really overlapping. In fact, one of the fathers of lifestyle medicine, Dean Ornish, was profoundly influenced by Swami Sathananda, who was a master teacher of Ayurveda. And so these ideas are not new, but they have been proven for human health over millennia, and now are gaining traction within the medical community, which is beautiful to see.
It really is. And I don't have that training, but I'm beginning to understand it more, especially like when you think of, again, I don't have this training, but when you think of someone who runs cold and then they can use certain spices or certain foods to heat up the body, for example, that is a little bit like Ayurveda, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. These constitutions, if you will. Doshas is the word in Ayurveda. You see constitutions in Chinese medicine. But even without using that language, I use that a lot in clinical practice. And you do see this in the lifestyle medicine recommendations as well. So for example, hot flashes, that is a disorder of heat, right? It is hot. And when you look at the nutrition, the handout that we put together from the menopause subcommittee, you see foods that are cooling, right? They're full of water, cucumber, watermelon, things that hold water like the flaxseed, the lignans draw water in. These are cooling foods, avoiding alcohol, which is hot, avoiding, you know, very heating spices like ginger. Sometimes people say that soup is too hot. You know, they prefer cold foods. People generally eat cold foods during the summer. You know, there's a seasonal relationship too of foods and how we move through the natural rhythms of the year. And so bringing some of that in, I think, brings a lot of richness to clinical practice and is a really wonderful way for folks to eat seasonally. We know that foods that are in season and are grown locally have higher nutrition content, and foods that are in season tend to also be right for the season in that sense as well.
Oh, I need to keep that in mind. I always think of seasonal foods and wanting to incorporate them more as, you know, being fresher and ripe and something to eat. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that the seasonal foods exist for a reason, and they can support us in our health if we consume them right during that time.
So I think so too. I mean, you look at the fall and winter foods, those tend to be things that are roots that are grown underground, things that are, you know, the hard fall or winter squashes. From a, you know, conventional perspective, they're very high in vitamin C. They're good things that are good for our immune health and well-being throughout those winter months. But also when you look at the foods, they're grown in hard shells, they're grown underground. They're things that kind of fortify us for those winter months, as opposed to summer where it is warm and we're eating more delicate foods with lots of water content.
This is Awesome. I'm going to prepare for the fall. I'm definitely going to focus more on those squashes because I just continue to eat what I enjoy throughout the year. But it's also because I don't have a lot of recipes that include those root vegetables. Well, the squashes and things like that, for example, pumpkin, I only associate it with pumpkin pie or pumpkin pudding.
Right.
But, you know, putting it in a stew, for example, just kind of being a little bit more creative would be fun.
You know, what's funny about the fall is that pumpkin spice, you know, that hits everywhere September 1st. Pumpkin spice, before it was a Starbucks thing, when you look at the spices in there, they're warming spices, right? They're cardamom, cinnamon, ginger, like they are their barks and roots and they're warming. And we see this used again in these long-term health systems for fortification in the winter months. So we think of it as pumpkin spice, but you know, this is really a chai spice or a root spice.
Yeah. Okay. It makes sense. And it's so funny that you emphasize Starbucks because I feel like they have highlighted that. Like before I gave up dairy, I would look forward to the fall drinks because I would have like a latte at Starbucks. And I would look forward to those spices that they create during the fall, spiced up coffees. And those were a lot of fun for me. And last year I made for the first time for my husband, I made him a traditional, what is called like a fruit punch tea, warm tea that we make in Mexico. It's called ponche. And it has, it's got like sugar cane, like the actual cane and other like guava or guayaba and like a small, I don't know what they call it in English, but it's like a small apple, that you only see it seasonally in the fall. So, he loved it. And this time what I decided not to do is add all that extra sugar that they typically add with like a raw sugar called piloncillo. And so I minimized the sugar. I think it had tamarind in it. You just imagine all these fall fruits. So, Dr. Kennard, so I would love to talk about physical activity. And I know that with lifestyle medicine, again, verbiage is so important. And so in the past, I think it was like in 2019, I attended at the Lifestyle Medicine Conference, a lecture titled Exercise is Medicine. I don't know if you were there at that time. That was a wonderful lecture that talked about how just like pharmaceutical reps dress up in their outfits to, you know, visit a doctor's office and sell them prescription medication, how nice it would be if health coaches, personal trainers did the same thing and showed up in suits at the doctor's office and to say, hey, I have something that could benefit your patients. So I love that in lifestyle medicine, we're careful about how we talk about that topic, that we encourage physical activity rather than, you know, overwhelming patients that they have to run marathons, for example, or hit the gym every day. Just being more physically active is so important. And so, as you know, many of us that are in the lifestyle medicine world partner with organizations like Walk with the Doc, just to encourage that physical movement. Now, we're talking about women's health. How can regular physical movement or exercise contribute to bone health? Because that's something that I just recently learned about. Mental health, which we've spoken about as well, mental well-being, hormonal balance, and particularly just all of this as we're going through life changes. How can physical activity help us?
Well, physical activity is so important, but particularly in the menopause transition and moving past being postmenopausal and healthy aging. I think it is sometimes overwhelming to women when a doctor brings up physical activity. We're all so busy already. Things feel overwhelming. We don't have time to spend an hour at the gym. You know, I know for me, I've been a little bit slow to go back to group exercise after the pandemic. So what do we do? And I encourage folks to think about working smarter, not harder on this one. You know, the recommendation of 150 minutes per week breaks down to 30 minutes 5 days a week. The most impactful way to spend that is right after eating. So when you move your muscles after eating, it recruits the blood sugar to be processed and get into the cells sooner. And so in that sense, it is protective against diabetes to exercise after eating. So, you know, you'll hear a 10-minute walk after eating. You know, it sounds minor, but it is impactful in terms of well-being and blood glucose metabolism, which is a big issue, particularly as we age, and influences metabolic syndrome as well. For folks that need to particularly be concerned about bone health, it is recommended to do strength training. This doesn't necessarily mean that you need to lift weights. Body weight is fine, and there's been head-to-head trials showing that yoga is actually effective for preserving bone health as well, but compared to aerobic exercise. And for hot flashes, mild to moderate exercise is better for reducing hot flashes, whereas very vigorous exercise can sometimes aggravate hot flashes. Back to that idea of kind of excess heat, you know. A lot of folks struggle with joint pain and orthopedic injuries, and warm water exercise can be really, really beautiful for those folks. I find warm water exercise is also excellent for people with history of complex trauma or chronic pain syndromes. That warm water is incredibly impactful in making positive movement in their chronic pain. A lot of times community centers too will have a warm water pool with very low cost water aerobics in the pool. So that's something to check into in your local community. And some physical therapist office have a warm water pool as well, and can even recruit insurance payment for helping somebody improve their mobility.
Well, I love this list. You answered my question immediately when you talked about warm water exercises, especially if you're suffering from joint pain, because I could see how people would be limited in wanting to do anything if they're not feeling well, if their joints are hurting. So community centers may be a good option for that. I love that. The other one that I just learned from you is excessive exercise creates that excessive heat and can contribute to hot flashes. That's very interesting. And I can also see how yoga, which contributes to stress management, also reducing that stress, could also help reduce hot flashes and still help with strength training, depending on the pose and all of that.
Absolutely. And balance. You know, one of the main things with preventing falls as we age is keeping our proprioception intact, which is our sense of ourselves in space, mm-hmm. and improving balance to reduce falls.
Mm-hmm. And you teach gentle yoga as well. I love that the topics we're talking about covers people with different abilities. So whether you're younger in your 40s, I say younger, but, you know, and have, you know, just full energy and strength, to whether you're like 75, 80, or whatever age you may be and may have already start to experience lack of mobility, even doing something like chair yoga. I was watching some of the videos that you've created, I think are awesome. So I'm going to make sure that towards the end, we talk about websites that people can check out your videos as well. So I like that. And then the gentle walks, well, I say gentle, but walks after dinner, that makes sense, because there are certain cultures and communities that have that kind of ritual of going out to walk after a dinner or after a meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, as my mentor, Dr. Lowdog, says, people don't do things for thousands of years that don't work. You know, there's a reason these sorts of rhythms are baked into daily culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Moving on to another pillar of lifestyle medicine, which I've begun to offer more support when it comes to moving away from alcohol, or at least changing your relationship with alcohol. I've had sobriety coaches on. Now, Dr. Kennard, this is a very different approach and that I've come upon as I myself moved away from alcohol. But there's like this whole sober curious movement that's happening. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this.
I am. And I'm actually a sober curious person too.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
this is wonderful. See, not a coincidence. Or is it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. That the more that we learn about health, the more we understand that we have the choice to change our relationship. For example, we've been in a culture that associates alcohol with everything, every event, whether it's a funeral, whether it's a wedding, with a graduation, or just relaxing at home. I didn't even know about the term mommy juice until I got into this movement. It's like, what? Because I didn't have children, so I didn't know that women, you know, found sort of a way to cope by drinking together. I don't know. So if you'd like to speak on that and why, how does that change and help improve that whole experience as we're aging? I've already talked about that once I made the decision to move away from drinking, I suddenly no longer experience hot flashes.
Yeah, this is an emerging area of research. So for a long time, red wine was considered healthful, part of the Mediterranean diet in moderation, one glass a day for women. A lot of benefit attributing to the resveratrol, which is a phytonutrient, powerful antioxidant, as well as the effects on cardiovascular health. And there's been more emerging research very recently in the last year or two, really questioning the idea if any alcohol is healthful. We know that alcohols increase cancer risk. For women, it increases breast cancer risk. And as we already covered, can be a precipitator of hot flashes. It's not good for bone health. And can have a detrimental influence on the microbiome as well. But as you said, it's just baked in ubiquitously in culture. And, you know, this mom culture of, you know, drinking together, or having a drink with the kids, your kids are bugging you. Like, I get that. My kids are 7 and 2. And so I think part of the sober curious movement is not only the becoming aware of the potential health influences of alcohol, but really more of a cognitive behavioral approach of, why do you want to drink? Is it because, you know, you really love this drink and you want to have one and fully enjoy it? Is it a buffering activity that you want to drink so that you don't experience a more uncomfortable or complex emotion? You know, these sorts of things, I think, also weigh into health in a very subtle but important way, that when we use anything as a buffer, alcohol, shopping, social media, scrolling, whatever it is, you know, it's not contributing to good mental health. Whereas if somebody has a drink because they really love that. You know, I live in wine country, and so there's a few wineries that, you know, I really love to have a glass of their wine, and I know the winemaker, and I'm looking at the grapes, and it's a, you know, just a really beautiful immersive experience. But that's very different than drinking because my kids are bothering me and I want to zone out, you know? And so it's a personal journey for sure. But I think starting along those questions of being sober curious and of course wanting the best for our bodies, but also wanting the best for our minds and making choices that are in support of those goals.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well said. It is very personal, which is why when I do bring on a coach, a sober curious coach, I sort of just present it as an option for my listeners, but not something that I want to shame people about or, you know, be hardcore about. I know that as I have worked with my life coach, it's become easier for me to be present with what I'm dealing with, coping. You know, she really guides me in terms of experiencing those emotions that I know that at one point I didn't want to experience. So numbing myself with alcohol, what seemed the easiest way to cope. And the more work that we've done, the easier it's gotten to not have to, I wrote down the word buffer because I love that you said that, I without having to use anything to buffer what I'm experiencing, but being okay with not being okay at times is also why I love having a coach that has helped me. And like I said, the other life coaches, the other like sober curious coaches that I bring on really have created these support systems to for women who, you know, who want to come off alcohol or who might be dependent on alcohol. So it is a very personal choice. So I'm going to move on to stress management because I feel like everything we talk about, everything is tied in together. I mean, part of the reason that people drink is to manage stress. And then when we're not in, you know, managing our stress, we're not eating well. We're not getting adequate sleep, and we're definitely not necessarily exercising. So stress management is highlighted as a key component of well-being. Could you discuss the effects of stress on women's health and share effective stress reduction techniques?
Mm-hmm. So stress is something we talked about briefly with the microbiome and the vagus nerve, and there is no part of the body, mind, or spirit that stress doesn't affect. And so stress management is absolutely key. I think that it's important to frame stress management from both a personal and a systems perspective, if you will. And so we talk a lot about the personal things that we can do for stress, you know, the mind-body practices, breath work. I would even put, you know, prioritizing good restorative sleep in there, good nutrition, that all goes together to buffer our experience of stress to not be unhealthy. And people can choose from a buffet of, you know, whatever works well. I really am a big proponent of mindfulness-based stress reduction courses. That's kind of the original in terms of looking at the most robust data. But I also really love Kristen Neff's work in self-compassion. Self-compassion is absolutely key to managing stress and the bumps of life. As Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's the founder of MBSR, says, you cannot control the waves, but you can learn to surf. And so other things, yoga, qigong, tai chi, breath work. But zooming out to this bigger question of what makes you feel like you, this is going to be different for everyone, right? For me as an introvert, I love to read. I love my garden. I love to have creative pursuits. For somebody else, that might look totally different. And then seeking the kind of rest that we need, because sleep is only one kind of rest. But from a systems perspective, we can do all of those things and also still have tremendous stress by life circumstances. And so thinking about doing what we can to reverse engineer a life that works for us. For example, for me as an obstetrician, it was taking less overnight call. You know, that had a profound impact on my stress and well-being. And, you know, we are subject to lots and lots of stressors that are not controllable. And so adjusting other things where possible to support, I think is worth a thoughtful conversation, at least with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So I'm writing down all these things that really stand out. And what you just said, what makes you feel like you, is so beautiful. Because immediately, of course, in my mind, I know what makes me feel like me. I also want to share that I'm using an app. I can't remember the name of it right now, but I'm using an app that allows me to log in how I spend my time. And the reason that I started using this app, Dr. Kennard, is because many times we hear ourselves saying, I don't have time for self-care. I don't have time to downshift. I don't have time to spend time with my loved ones. And so I decided to see where my time is going. And so sometimes it tracks you and it'll say you were at this location. What were you doing? Some people might not want an app like that. But I've been using it for over a week. And it's sort of like an experiment that I'm doing on myself. But what I'm doing are two things that I'm going to focus on, which is, what am I doing that I don't really like to do? So I'm tracking that. And am I doing enough of what I enjoy doing? One of the things is, like, for example, spending quality time with my husband, having more time in nature, getting that massage that I really love to have from time to time. And those are the kind of things that make me feel more like me. And we are going to talk about those, the importance of social connections, but those are the things that are very rich to myself, to my life. When I'm cooking for pleasure and not out of an obligation to eat at the moment, there are differences. And so I love that you're saying that nutrition and sleep, all of that plays a role into how we manage stress or how those things affect our stress levels as well. And then I wanted to ask you briefly, you mentioned stress reduction courses.
Lots of good things. The ones that I have done and recommended with good results to folks, mindfulness-based stress reduction is probably the first and most well-studied. You can find those courses all over the world. I'm a big fan of the self-compassion course and workbook by Kristen Neff, Applying Mindfulness to Compassion for Self, which I think, especially for women, is very, very difficult and is incredibly impactful when you start to think differently. And you might think it's not possible to think differently, because that's what I thought. And we don't have to believe our thoughts. Our brains are plastic. They can change. And thinking about speaking to yourself as you would a very dear loved one is really a pivotal shift, I think, in stress reduction. In terms of eating, I love the Eat Right Now app by Dr. Judson Brewer, applying mindfulness to eating and to weight management. For those of you that are NSEN, the Enhanced Stress Resiliency Training from University of California, San Francisco is wonderful. There's lots of options, but something that has a established curriculum and support will help most people complete the program.
Awesome. I'm going to definitely check out the self-compassion book. That one sounds interesting. What do you think about heart math? Do you recommend that?
Oh, that's really neat. Yeah. So heart rate variability, this is absolutely fascinating to me as an obstetrician, because the way that we gauge babies' well-beings in utero is by their heart rate variability that we monitor while they're still inside their person that they're growing in. And so we accept it as, you know, adequate monitoring for a fetus. And so this is the same idea for people that are out of the uterus and bigger, but absolutely the same, looking at the beat-to-beat variability between heartbeats as a measure of that parasympathetic nervous system tone that we spoke about earlier. And it's a powerful form of biofeedback to say, wow, look at that. And I can do this and change my heart rate variability, change my rhythms. And particularly for somebody that needs to gamify physical changes, or, you know, likes to see that, you know, very concrete evidence of change, it is a wonderful program that can show progress in terms of those mind-body exercises and breath work having a direct impact on physiology.
Technology has really improved so much. So now you have you have. And if you know more about it, please tell us. But it's sort of like a smaller apparatus that you attach or somehow syncs in with your phone, for example, your iPhone, to give you that biofeedback to show you how you are doing throughout the day.
Yeah, there's all kinds of wearables coming out now in terms of biofeedback, and now the next generation, which is claiming to actually change the nervous system, you know, via the wearable device. So I'm following along as well and curious.
That is so cool. All right. Finally, in terms of like the pillars of lifestyle medicine, we know that relationships are so important, feeling connected, especially as women age, and which is heartbreaking in the sense that as we age, our circles change. We're not as social for many reasons. So I was wondering if you can talk about that. Like, how does social interaction impact women's health, particularly during menopause? And what recommendations do you have for women to enhance their social connections?
Yes, I find this to be the most compelling part of the Blue Zones research by Dan Buettner, that the number one predictor of longevity and well-being is social connection. You know, we talk so much about nutrition and physical activity as the pillars of longevity and well-being. And really what bore out of that research was the importance of social connection. It's fascinating. And again, when you look in cultures with strong social connection, particularly for women and particularly after menopause, seeing that protective effect, you know, it's going to be very individualized how women maintain social connections, but it's important. And however someone wants to do that is fine, but it is truly key. And connections to healthy relationships with family, with friends. There's more and more emphasis now on mental health, and I'm glad to see resources springing up like teletherapy and, you know, low barrier, low cost options in terms of relationship support. I think that's wonderful, but knowing that relationships and social connection is really a key element of health and well-being, particularly in the aging process, is worth considering.
Yes. And I'm so glad that you brought up the Blue Zones. Big fan of the Blue Zones. I recently saw a video that he put out where he talked about the importance of getting the elderly involved, elderly family members involved in the family dynamics by giving them, you know, responsibilities that they'll be glad to be part of, like taking care of the grandchildren or getting them involved in the cooking process for those that keep their family, older family members around. Now, having a pet, would that also help our physical and emotional health?
Yeah, there's lots of data out there to show the positive influence of animal companions and of whatever species somebody prefers. And I think that's wonderful.
Yes. What would you say to our listeners who don't have an OB-GYN or just a primary care physician that has this training like you do? And what would you say to the listener that wants that from their physician? And then what would you say to a physician who is just getting started, and how could they advise their patients?
Yeah. So for the listener, appreciating what conventional medicine has to offer us, you know, the cancer screenings, hormone therapy when indicated, you know, all of the wonderful advancements that have come through medicine. And there are wonderful resources that are reputable in terms of learning about lifestyle medicine and health, healthy living out there. Some of my favorite resources are there courses on the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine that can be taken by anyone The American College of Lifestyle Medicine has some wonderful patient-facing resources. I love the books by Dr. Lowdog, who is a mentor of mine. And for a doctor, you know, I teach residents and I teach them both OBGYN and lifestyle and integrative medicine. And it is so wonderful to see the next generation of doctors come through and they want to learn about this. They voluntarily enroll in extra time to learn about these topics that were gaps in their previous training in medical school. And so I really do think we are on the precipice of a new generation of a physician workforce that values these lifestyle modalities. And so for those young doctors or doctors already in practice that are looking for a new way, considering any of the courses from both the University of Arizona, Andrew Weil Center, the fellowship, joining the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, getting involved in one of the member interest groups to learn more. There's just lots of low cost, low barrier options to start to improve your knowledge base on this and do what you love. You know, it's wonderful to be a lifelong learner. One of my favorite things is learning about culinary medicine. So looking into one of the programs that teaches that, like Tulane. If you love mind-body medicine, maybe look into, you know, becoming a mindfulness instructor. I have several friends that are MDs that have done that. Whatever floats your boat, it's all good. You know, a rising tide lifts all boats. And despite the challenges in the current health system, I truly am optimistic that this generation and the next generation of doctors is turning the tide.
Yes, I too am optimistic, despite the fact that every day it seems like someone approaches us locally here in Dallas and wants to know, is there a physician that you can recommend that has this training? And it's like, no, but you know what? You can learn this for yourself on your own and then hopefully help educate your doctor. But I'm in agreement with you, Dr. Kennard, that I want to be very respectful and to continue to honor the healthcare providers that have spent years of their lives learning how to be excellent physicians. And so they are still beneficial to us. All of you are. I want to bring it back real quickly to the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. We saw a tremendous growth in membership during the pandemic. It's incredible how many people are coming on board. Are we at 10,000 members now?
Yes, I believe so.
It's incredible. And you're involved in the Women's Health Member Interest Group. You're the co-chair for the Menopause Committee, which is such an important topic. And we've already talked about it. We also talked about the piece that you wrote in response to that article at, in the New York Times that basically sort of said, hey, there's nothing else that women can do as they're going through menopause. To reduce their, the symptoms, the hot flashes and other things like that. But we've just gone through this entire conversation. We've already covered the pillars of lifestyle medicine, and there are things that women can do to experience menopause more gracefully without so many complications.
Yeah, absolutely. Hormones work well for hot flashes, and there are lots of things, not only from a hot flash perspective, but really from an aging well perspective, because that's what I want to shift the conversation to. You know, vasomotor symptoms are just one symptom, but what we really care about is women have long lifespans now on average, and they spend almost half of their lives postmenopausal. And so making those decades well, you know, that's really what is the meaningful work here.
Yes. Yes. More than half their lives postmenopausal?
Almost half. You know, if you look at women that are, you know, living to near 90, an average age of menopause is 51. You know, that's a lot of years.
Oh, my goodness. If people are interested in reaching out, are you available?
Yes. I have a Facebook page and I'm happy to connect on social media and happy also to give some of my recipes and resources from the American College of Lifestyle Medicine that we've developed.
Yeah. Oh, this is exciting. I just love this. This is exactly why I like being part of the Women's Health Interest Group. And I love learning from ACLM because the power lies in our hands. All right. And so finally, Dr. Kennard, I'm going to the Lifestyle Medicine Conference this year. I'm always excited to meet people in person that I've only met virtually. What are there any highlights, anything you'd like to say about the conference?
It'll be a wonderful conference. You know, there's always really interesting people with a love of lifelong learning and shared interests and beautiful food.
Right?
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's just a great time. I hope it's not too cold in November. I know it's kind of like the end of October, early November in Denver. So it's probably going to be the first time I'm not going to be swimming during that time. It's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you for sharing all of these tools and resources with my listeners on how we can just continue to live our lives gracefully. Do you have any final thoughts, any other links that you'd like to share?
No, thank you so much for having me on. I'm so pleased to be able to have this conversation.
All righty. Thanks a lot. Thank you for being here.
You've been listening to the Healthy Lifestyle Solutions podcast with your host, Maya Acosta. If you've enjoyed this content, please share with one friend who can benefit. You can also leave us a 5-star review at ratethispodcast.com/HLS. This helps us to spread our message. As always, thank you for being a listener.